In this second part of Adrian Thatcher's lecture, he addresses contemporary views of marriage. He sees eight ways of looking at marriage: as a contract, as a covenant, as a sacrament, and so on. And at the end, there is an attempt to show the possibility of regarding same-sex union as having all the possibilities of marriage when considered from each of those eight perspectives. He reminds us of the Pauline view that whereas men are enjoined to love their wives, wives are supposed to be subservient to men in marriage, a view derived from the idea of marriage in part one of the lecture. On the whole, a cynical view is taken of marriage, particularly as espoused by the Roman Catholic Church. We are reminded of the idea that marriage between two persons is likened to the covenant between Christ and his Church. Then, we have the idea of a mutual giving of bodies, and here marriage, the mutual giving of bodies, can be likened to the giving by Christ of his body in the Eucharist. Furthermore, it seems that in Adrian's view, same-sex penetrative sex need not be thought of as in any way different from opposite-sex congress. Adrian claims that objections to homosexual activity arise not from dislike of anal sex, but from adherence to what may once have been a theological interpretation of man as the creature of God, and the unwelcome idea that the passive partner takes on the persona of a woman in defiance of God. This, I have to say, seems far-fetched to me. However, he likes to say that each of his eight models of marriage are equally admissible for men having sex with men as for men and women having sexual unions. There is next to nothing, however, about lesbian or bisexual unions.
Now I'm going to leap 2,000 years into a contemporary Christian theology. And the link between the two will enable me to speak for the last 10 minutes about how gay marriage may fit. I've taken eight models of marriage from contemporary Christian marital theology. And I'm going to give each about 1 or 2 minutes. It was so disappointing to read the Church of England's response to the government consultation about gay marriage. Because instead of drawing on the resources of faith, it went to the Oxford Dictionary and said, marriage is a union of one man with one woman for life. Well, it might be, but that's not theology. That is taking the definition out of the air in order to exclude others from its embrace. That's what that was. If we went to the rich tradition of theology, as could have been done, then the government might have been educated instead of being told what to do. So first then, a union of heart, body and mind. Jesus himself spoke of marriage as one flesh, citing Genesis 2:24, where the term first occurs. And immediately he adds, therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Various meanings have been sought to flow from this uncompromising definition of marriage. Most obviously, that a marriage approved by God is indissoluble. In the Genesis story, the man and the woman are one flesh. Because the woman has been made from the flesh and bones of the man sees his flesh and recognizes himself. Now, the saying about one flesh has not been favourable to women over time. It's been used to support the legal inclusion of a wife's body and property within her husband's body and property. She belonged to her husband in a total, irrevocable and unidirectional way. Second in the order of creation and deriving from the man, she is second in the hierarchy of gender. But one flesh does not have to be read forever in that sexist way. It can also stand for a union of body, heart and mind where there is no gender harm. Whether the one flesh has to be the combination of a man and a woman is a question to be decided later. Second model, a covenant. An important document from the Second Vatican Council says, the intimate partnership of married life and love has been established by the Creator and qualified by his laws and is rooted in the conjugal covenant of irrevocable personal consent. apparently for the first time in a Roman Catholic thought, is called a fuius, a covenant, an image and a sharing in the covenant of love between Christ and the Church. John Calvin is the author of the idea of marriage as a covenant in the Protestant traditions. And I always like to tease Roman Catholic scholars about this, reminding them that the origin of their fuius doctrine actually comes from one of the reformers, as indeed it does. Well, with careful qualification, God's relationship to God's people in the First Testament can be seen as a covenant. Well, part of the contemporary value of speaking of marriage as a covenant is its implied contrast with a contract. And Roman Catholic canon law before 1983 spoke of marriage as a contract. So it was a big change 30 years ago. The understanding of marriage as a covenant offered by the Church to marrying couples, whether or not they are believers, expresses the specialness of their intentions in a way that also nudges them towards faith, I think. Marriage offers a different level of human relationship that contrasts with other personal relationships and is also a defense against the temptation within advanced societies to treat people as things by introducing notions of dominance, or ownership, or calculation, or obsolescence. When you get fed up with a partner, well, ditch him or her and get a new one. The marriage requires, but can't be exhausted by, the legal frameworks that specify it. Couples may long for a language that articulates the meanings of their commitments in the first place to themselves, and covenant language provides it. The covenant, which is marriage, tells us about what Christianity is. And that's why my third model is an image of the new covenant. The Christian faith is nothing else but a covenant. We speak of the new covenant, or the New Testament. The new covenant is Christianity. It's what Christ seals with his own blood. It defines the arrangement of Christian scriptures into two parts. Pope John Paul II made the striking connection between the covenant of marriage and the covenant that is Christianity. The communion of love between God and the people, he said, finds a meaningful expression in the marriage covenant which is established between a man and a woman. What the Pope envisages here is the mingling of divine love with human love, such that human love comes to fruition in the partnership of the whole of life, which is a lovely medieval definition of marriage. So that phrase, consortium, that means partnership. Totius vitae means of the whole of life. Sometimes it's written omnia. Omnis vitae, it means the same thing. So this partnership then is already a sharing in the divine covenant with humankind and Christ's covenant with all the people of God. The bond of love between married couples is what they have in common with the covenant love of God for God's people. Use of the terms image and symbol here provide continuity between the two. Put in a pastoral way, couples are able to find their way to God through the love they already have for one another. And fourthly, marriage is a gift of bodies. Several writers have drawn attention to some of the parallels between the sacrament of the Eucharist and the sacrament of marriage. In fact, I've done that in my recent work as well. Such parallels are already latent in Ephesians 5. Christ gives us his body in the Eucharist. This is the erotic charge that the Eucharist undeniably has. The Eucharist is the giving of a body. Christ says, "This is my body." And the giving of bodies is something we do when we give ourselves to our partners and we receive our partners. that in the giving and receiving of persons, to and from each other, faithfully, exclusively and permanently, the new vista is capable of opening up. The physical expression of love becomes intertwined with the sharing of lives in deep commitment, unconditionally expressed by the self-giving of God for us in love and in death. That's why lots of writers call marriage these days a mimesis. That comes from the word to mimic. It means a strong representation or imitation of something else. Marriage at its best mimes the love of Christ for the church. The author of Ephesians would agree that marriage is a mimesis. After quoting the verse from Genesis that a married couple become one flesh, he adds, "This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church." That profound mystery in the Latin Vulgate is exactly that, a sacramental. Fifth, marriage is a sacrament of mutuality. I enjoy reminding Roman Catholics that the sacrament of marriage is the only sacrament of their seven that requires a woman to be able to have it at all. But it's also the only sacrament that did not need to be administered by a priest. A couple is validly married, assuming their impediment, and they make vows to each other in the present tense before witnesses. The priest pronounces them married and blesses them, but the blessing is not what makes the marriage, as it is in the Eastern Orthodox churches. The Council of Trent required the presence of a priest for the marriage to be valid. Both Catholics and Protestants reacted to the abuses of clandestine marriages by tightening their grip on the entry to marriage. But the presence of the priest or minister at a wedding should not eclipse the ancient understanding that the couple minister the sacrament to each other. And I think that is a wonderful thing about theology of marriage in the Middle Ages. The priest does not marry the man and the woman. People today talk about getting married as if it's something that is done to them. That is utterly foreign to the Christian understanding. The minister does not marry anyone. You can't do that. The couple marry each other. It is their marriage, and they do it in the exchange of vows, in the exchange of rings, in what is called a formative action. The couple always marry themselves. What the priest does is blesses marriage and is the first witness to the marriage on behalf of Christ and the church, which is why the priest will then bless the marriage. But it's the couple's marriage. It's their sacrament. That's the important point. And what I love about this is that the sacramental grace is not, as it were, injected by a priest from above at the moment some legal words are spoken. You know, so now it's a sacrament. Oh, aren't we glad about that? That's no defense whatever against the marriage cracking up. As we know, lots of sacramental marriages end up as a complete mess. What matters is finding the grace of God precisely as the couple continues to administer their sacrament to one another. In their household, in their joint bringing up of children, in their joint contributions to the budget, in their joint sharing of all the domestic chores, where men are still lamentably bad, or the literature shows. So that's how the sacramental grace, as it were, takes and adds something to it, because it's a sacrament of co-equal partners, each of whom, in the name of Christ, ministers. And that, I think, is a wonderful understanding of what a good marriage might be. So then we come to a kind of nuptial mysticism view, to use a theological term, which uses marriage in so many ways to speak about what happens at the end of time. That's to say, the very best marriages or marriage in its ideal state can become a form of love but a form of love in relationship which is capable of symbolizing what happens at the very end of time. Now, two more models of marriage, and I like this one, which comes from Pope John Paul II, but he would not be pleased with what I am about to do. Well, what he does is to say that marriage is a communion of persons, a communio personarum. And the thing is, that Pope understood that Christians speak of God as a communion of persons. That is what the Holy Trinity is. Three persons, yet one in the communion of each with all the others. And Pope John Paul wanted to say that marriage is an intense form, it's not the only form, of what a communion of persons can be like. And the thing that I really like about this is that if you're going to borrow analogies from the Trinity, you have got three co-equal persons. Any idea that the Father is greater than the Son or the Spirit is anathematized in the Athanasian Creed. The persons in God are all absolutely equal. There is no greater or lesser in God. There might be in early versions of gender, there's greater and lesser there. But in the very life of God, which is communion, the persons are co-equal, the persons are not sexed, each makes the other what he or she is, and the domination of one over the other is absolutely impossible, because all of them alike are God. So actually you have a wonderful example egalitarianism, an egalitarian kind of marriage, derived actually from the very heart of what Christians believe about God. And then finally, the idea of marriage as an aesthetic discipline, which Eugene Waters writes a lot about. He's saying, all Christians are required to be chaste, but who says it's easy to be chaste if you're married? Chastity applies there. Well, it's difficult to remain exclusively faithful to one's married partner. Marriage is a God-given institution, an ascetic discipline, and it shares with celibacy the difficulty of remaining chaste, and it needs grace to sustain it. Now, I want to come to some conclusions in the next 10 minutes. I want to refer to those eight models. I hope you'll acknowledge that all eight models are drawn from contemporary Roman Catholic and Protestant theology. Each one of those eight models is capable of application to persons of the same sex. Just look at them. Is a lesbian couple capable of coming together as a union of heart, body and mind? Well, of course they are. Can a couple of the same sex enter into the kind of covenant that a persons of the opposite sex can? Of course they can. Is there love for each other, an image of the new covenant, just as much as the love of a straight couple? Is marriage a gift of bodies in the case of a same-sex couple? Of course it is. Could it be a sacrament of mutuality? Of course it could. And indeed, there is some evidence that same-sex couples can teach straight couples a lot about mutuality and sharing and equality. Is it a sign of the coming kingdom? Why not? Is it a communion of persons? It certainly is. Get it? Is it subject to the same discipline? Definitely. If it's marriage, then it's for life. It requires the ascetic concentration of and so you see, this is the argument, that those, all of those eight models are capable of application to couples who are of the same sex. So I've not discussed specifically I've not really brought into the discussion much about how the churches have dealt with the broader question of homosexuality. But what I've said about gender, and how gender is a homosexuality, because that word was only invented in 1869, where it means something quite different. But yes, men were having sex with men, which is why Leviticus 18 says, well, kill them both if you catch them at it. So what's wrong with it? What's wrong with it is that it is, as I say up here, gender infraction. So, if a man becomes the passive partner in a sexual act with another man, it's obvious what happens. He feminizes himself. He becomes a woman. And since men have the image of God more than women do, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, although we don't like to be reminded that he says that with the clarity that he does, anyone who is the passive partner in a sex act between men that involves penetration, that man has in effect made himself a woman, and God made him a man. And so that's a disgraceful betrayal of his masculinity. It is what Diana Swanger calls the disease of the feminine. And later that view was added by a second view was added to it. That, of course, sex from the second century onward in the Christian church is only for procreation. So, any sex at all that isn't heterosexual and that involves the mingling of two seeds, that is completely out of order because it is baby making. So, I do think that if you don't say this, that you will find in the Bible a condemnation of both men and sex with men. But what I've tried to do is to provide the two main reasons why the Bible thinks that's wrong. Not because there's something called homosexuality that God is alleged to dislike, but because that there is an ancient view about gender and an ancient view about the purpose of sex that none of us here in this room actually accept. We don't think that there are two seeds. We don't think that seed is wasted if it isn't put to appropriate purpose. We do think that people of the same gender are capable of love. We don't think that same-sex sex is wrong for the reasons that it was held to be wrong in Leviticus and in Romans. And especially in Romans, where, I've got this somewhere, yes, where it's pretty clear that St. Paul, when he talks about the glory of God being exchanged, that what is in his mind is precisely that the appearance or the image of God in men is compromised when men choose to act as if they are. That kind of view of sex and of gender is something that, I mean, almost all Christians have abandoned, even those who are against gay marriage, as very many of them are against it for different reasons. So I haven't said much about how Christianity deals with what has been called in the last 150 years homosexuality, because I've been asked to talk about gay marriage, which is a different topic. And the point about that with which I close is that all those eight models are capable of application to the unions that lesbian and gay Christians are asking for themselves. So this isn't simply, as I'm often accused of doing, compromising with the spirit of the age, or just indulging in a liberal theology which just really kind of puts a theological gloss on what the world is doing. These are very, very deep models of marriage which are in use now in the Vatican and in churches all over the world. And you can see that the application of them in a new context is something that actually